You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Whenever police question an adult in their custody, they're required to give them a Miranda warning to inform them of their rights. If you're a crime show fan, you can probably recite it. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law, and so on. But when it comes to students in school, it's not always clear when the warning should be given. One such case has made its way to Kentucky Supreme Court. Shelley Baskin reports on the profound and wide-ranging impact the court's decision could have on the way school administrators discipline students.
In the spring of 2009, a Nelson County high school teacher found an empty prescription pain pill bottle in a school bathroom. The bottle had the name of a student on it. The student, referred to in court documents by the letters NC because he's a minor, was removed from class by the school's resource officer, Nelson County Sheriff's Deputy Stephen Campbell. Officer Campbell took the student to Assistant Principal Michael Glass's office for questioning. While in Glass's office, the student admitted to having the pills and giving at least one to another student, a crime which he was later convicted of based on his admission. NC argues that his statement to Glass and Campbell should have been suppressed during his trial because he did not receive a Miranda warning, despite considering himself to be in custody. The court now has to decide if a student being questioned by a school administrator and resource officer is considered to be in custody. The Department of Public Advocacy's Tim Arnold says it makes sense that a student being questioned would feel compelled to obey.
We are conditioned from the time we're 5 years old, at the very least, to recognize school as an environment where we are expected to comply with the directives of school officials, and there will be consequences if we don't comply.
Arnold says that makes it important to set rules and policies that make it clear when a particular incident is being addressed by the school or by law enforcement. Kentucky Association of School Administrators Executive Director Wayne Young says the problem is that sometimes an administrator thinks they're dealing with a simple school discipline issue.
Some cases don't come to them as criminal matters, but as you develop evidence and proof of what happened, you may uncover some criminal act underlying something.
Young says requiring administrators to determine if a student may eventually be prosecuted goes beyond the scope of their position.
Let's not make principals the enforcers of the constitutional requirement to advise people of their rights if they're being prosecuted.
Hopkins County Attorney Todd Peeple is responsible for prosecuting juvenile cases in his county. Peeple says he's dealt with cases similar to this one, and he thinks it's reasonable to apply less stringent standards for due process to preserve the safety of other students.
Most students in Kentucky public schools understand that they're subject to questioning and they're subject to searches and seizures when they're on school property. And that's a different standard, again, than if you're just a citizen on the street being investigated by the police.
But DPA attorney Tim Arnold says while it's true that students are subject to different rules while at school, school officials should avoid exercising their authority over students beyond the usual school discipline and educational matters.
Police have plenty of resources already to interrogate people, and they do it all the time. You know, there's no reason why we need to bring that into the school setting for the purposes of serving that enforcement need.
Both sides agree that whatever decision the court makes in the case, school discipline procedures will definitely be affected. Arnold says not informing students when they could be facing prosecution could prevent them from talking to administrators about other problems. But County Attorney Peeple says expanding due process requirements for students could end up protecting guilty students as well. But for one Nelson County student, the decision has another aspect. He's waiting to see if he'll spend 45 days in jail. For WKMS News, I'm Shelley Baskin.
As our region heads into the holiday season, we've been speaking with the area's Chamber of Commerce executives to see how their communities are faring in what's traditionally a boom time for businesses. Today, Kate Lochte speaks with Paducah Area Chamber of Commerce President Elaine Spaulding.
Thank you for being with us. And may I begin with asking you, what's your sense of the general vibe amongst Paducah McCracken retailers about the season of retail shopping?
Well, everyone in our entire region is very excited about the upcoming holiday season. We kicked it off with our regional trade show in October, and we had all of the regional chambers of commerce participate and a number of businesses that were showcasing their latest products and services that they offer to the entire region. And I think that's the real beauty of where we live. Folks get out and about and get over to Grand Rivers and to Murray and Paducah and Mayfield and, you know, all parts in between. So we love to celebrate the entire holiday season with our partners across the region.
Do you think business is booming? How would you rate it?
I think, we haven't had any statistics on this year, but if you look at the past, this past year, of course, the annual retail sales for McCracken County are $3.7 billion. We are the number one retail sales per capita city in the entire state of Kentucky. So I think that speaks to the whole regional aspect. We have folks come, you know, not only from all over West Kentucky, but southern Illinois and parts of Missouri and Tennessee. And so that's why this area has just been so blessed for so many years.
Is this a particular growth spurt, or is this figure pretty consistent?
I think it has been stable for quite some time. Any of the new retailers that come into the community always say that their first quarter sales are better than any other stores they have. And so we continue to grow, and I think because of the regional aspect, really prosper from everyone in the region coming in.
I want to ask you about your sense of the businesses that you pay attention to, what they're doing online. Do you get a read that there are more online promotions this year than before?
Well, I certainly am getting a number of e-newsletters from many of our local and regional businesses, and I think folks are using social media a great deal to offer extra discounts off their products and services. You know, you can get things at some of the local spas. They'll tell you when they have openings that week, and you can get a discount if you can snag one of those open times for a facial or a massage, which is always, always helpful with all of the Christmas rush. So I would encourage people to take advantage of those opportunities, too.
So we're ending, nearing the end of a very active year politically. What would you say the Chamber's biggest opportunities have been this year and biggest challenges?
Well, I think always with the business community, we are business advocates, all of the chambers in the region, looking out for our business communities and making sure that, particularly in the state of Kentucky, looking at the tax reform panel that is meeting, and of course we have John Williams Sr. that's serving on that panel for us. All of the business leaders are very concerned about the recommendations that will come out of that, and they have not quite finished their work yet, but looking at the 2013 state legislative session and making sure that our elected officials know that it's very important to really be very sensitive for our small business community and making sure that you don't put any undue tax burden on the business community.
What's the sense of the committee so far with respect to that particular element?
Well, I think they are. They're very, very sensitive. They know, particularly in our region, that we need to tread very carefully. We're all very concerned about one of our major employers, the USEC plant, and what may unfold for them this next year. So we want to make sure that everybody is looking out for the business community and making sure that they do no harm.
What's ahead for the Paducah Area Chamber of Commerce in terms of advocacy for federal projects?
We actually are taking that to our board of directors this next week for our 2013 advocacy positions, and of course advocating for the USEC plant, keeping that plant open as long as we possibly can, and then the transition dollars from the federal level for the cleanup funds will continue to be our top priority.
I notice the downtown riverfront development, which is, I think, still pending, sort of. What's the latest in that area?
Well, we actually just had the big they didn't call it a groundbreaking. It was a fill-in ceremony with a beautiful colored sand to start the first phase of the downtown riverfront ceremony, and everyone there got lots of sand in their faces because it was a very windy day. So that ceremony happened just a couple weeks ago, and that first phase of the riverfront development includes a dock, a marina, which we receive a number of calls both in the chamber offices and the Convention and Visitors Bureau offices about folks who want to stop with recreational vehicle boats and enjoy downtown Paducah. So we'll be able to do that when they complete their work. It's still a couple of years out. I think with the change in the way our federal government, state governments, you know, just really do not have those kind of capital project funds anymore. So the rest of it, I think, will continue to be on the back burner.
Elaine, there's been a lot of news recently about the closure of the Mississippi from St. Louis to Cairo, a proposal because of water levels. What's the impact in Paducah?
Well, definitely very important for our river industry. There are over 6,000 employees in our region that work with the river industry, and we are very concerned about that. We have been in communication with Senator McConnell, Senator Paul, and Congressman Whitfield, who have all been extremely supportive in trying to convince the Corps of Engineers to make sure that those water levels are high enough for the commercial barge traffic to get their products up and down the inland waterways. And that's such a vital part of our economy. We want to do everything we can to encourage them to continue to keep those water levels up.
What's your understanding of the likelihood that they will?
Well, the Corps of Engineers obviously has lots of different issues that they evaluate. However, we know that our federal delegation is doing everything they can to help us.
I hear tell that your chamber offices are going into new digs.
Well, right. Actually, historic digs. We're real excited. The Paducah Economic Development Group, Entre Paducah, our entrepreneurial development division, and the Paducah Area Chamber of Commerce are relocating, and that will happen shortly after the first of the year in 2013. And Mr. Kenny Hunt with A&K Construction actually bought what is the old freight building just a couple of blocks from where we are, but it'll be nice because it's right on the main road coming into downtown. And I think folks will be able to stop there, and it'll be a one-stop shop for our entire business community.
Okay, here's the big one. What would you like Santa to bring the chamber for Christmas?
I would like for everyone in the entire region to get out there and support our regional businesses. Buy local in your community and buy regional all across this beautiful, beautiful part of the state that we're blessed to live in.
Thank you, Elaine.
Uh-huh.
Kate Lochte spoke with Paducah Area Chamber of Commerce President Elaine Spaulding from her office in Paducah.
Well, Paducah, Paducah, if you want it, you can rhyme it with bazooka. But you can't poo-poo Paducah, it's another word for paradise. Well, Paducah, Paducah, just a pretty little city in Kentucky. But to me, it rhymes with lucky when I'm looking at it through blue eyes. Well, two at the time, they get excited about two good time, but I'm delighted by Julep time, because I happen to love a resident of Paducah. Paducah, if you want it, you can rhyme it with bazooka, but you can't do Paducah, because it's another word for paradise. Here we go, Josh Connor.
When we come back, we'll hear conversations with the executive director of Paducah's Yeiser Arts Center and the WKMS voice that's adapted a Dickens masterpiece for the Playhouse in the Park stage. We'll also find out what it means to have a very Reddit Christmas. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Reddit.com is one of the largest online communities in the world. Members submit story links or blog posts, and the community votes on whether they like or dislike the content. The site receives more than 40 million hits a month, and now it's home to one of the largest, if not the largest, Secret Santa gift exchange in the world. Our own John Walker is participating in Reddit's Secret Santa this year, and he gives us an inside look into the worldwide culture of anonymous gift giving.
I'm a Redditor. I was introduced to the website by a friend last winter and soon became an addict. I vote, submit, and read posts in Reddit's many categories called subreddits. My next step? Joining Reddit's Secret Santa. It started as a gift exchange for Reddit members 4 years ago.
So I made a post to ask Reddit, and we created our Secret Santa subreddit, and over the following week or two, we started writing the code and making what would become Reddit gifts.
That's user Daniel McComas. He created the gift exchange as a way to celebrate his favorite holiday. By its second year, the program became so popular, Reddit decided to take over the exchange.
After we were acquired, we started our Secret Santa for the third time and had close to 40,000 people sign up, broke a world record. It was overwhelming and exciting.
Now, in its fourth year, McComas expects 60,000 users to send gifts to people they've probably never met. Registering is easy. A user signs up and is then matched to a Secret Santa through the program McComas designed. I'll send my gifts to a woman in Western Canada who is most excited about giving gifts, she says in her profile, though she does give me some hints on what she'd like. She wants something that would teach her about my community and my hobbies. I'm sending her a box filled with a Murray State blanket and some brochures from the Murray Tourism Office. I'm also sending her two books by my favorite Kentucky authors, Jesse Stewart and Wendell Berry. Lee Rainey directs the Pew Research Center's Internet Project, which studies the Internet's social impact. He says communities like Reddit establish themselves by having an impact on real-life events.
This is a way now, especially in instances like this kind of altruism, where the community can sort of announce to the world that these things really matter to us and we're not just defined by these things that maybe the public currently understands about us. We've got a bigger mission in the world and we've got a bigger heart than you might think we have.
Like any large group of people, there's always a few bad apples. Reddit Gifts bans members who sign up but don't send gifts, though that's only a small minority. And the exchange lets people rematch. As for me, I'm much more interested in the giving than the receiving. But like anyone else, I just don't want to get gypped. For WKMS News, I'm John Walker.
The Iser Arts Center has been promoting art and artists to the Paducah community for more than half a century. The center features local and international exhibits of all kinds of visual art. It also operates the only officially designated Kentucky crafted gift shop in far western Kentucky. The Iser Executive Director Josh White joins Angela Hatton to talk about how the center is working to keep the visual arts thriving in our region.
You have exhibitions at the Iser, you host classes, you even sell arts and crafts, so it's a center that's very involved in the arts community, the visual arts community. And I want to pick your brain on why you think it is so important to support local art.
Well, I think Paducah has really created a whole culture around the arts now, and it's so exciting for us to be kind of the hub of that arts culture. Lower Town, the Paducah Art Guild, the Wastelanders, they all kind of filter through our doors and are all separately involved in our work. So it's really interesting to be a common ground for many different arts communities in our town and to be making such a difference in paving the way for the arts in Paducah.
And do you think, I mean, Paducah is not just in and of itself, it's also a part of a region, and I think that's because we're in a rural area, I think region becomes something that we speak about more than you would, say, in a city like Nashville or Chicago,
yeah,
where it's more urban-based. Do you think that the mission of supporting art is different in a rural area like western Kentucky than it is in some of those larger cities?
Might be more challenging, I think. It's definitely an interesting perspective, I think, when you are in a small town as we are, and especially a region like we are, as opposed to other places like Nashville, like you mentioned. It's really, really challenging to connect with the community when the community is several miles away from your base, you know?
But you mentioned recently, actually, you were interviewed for Paducah Life magazine, and you mentioned in there that Paducah is a city that is small town, but it doesn't really feel like a small town. I wonder if you could share your thoughts on that again.
Okay. It doesn't feel small town for me because when I explain, you know, when I go home, like for Thanksgiving, I'm from Savannah. When I was home for Thanksgiving, I explain, you know, what's Paducah like? Well, it's a small town, but there's seven big institutions, a symphony, you know, independent theater, really, really cool River Discovery Center. They're always having different events, and it just creates for a thriving little community.
Currently, what you have up is called the Members Show, which, as the name suggests, features work by members of the Iser Arts Center, and it's billed on the website as one of the most anticipated shows of the year. Why is that?
This is my first member show that I've overseen, and I can definitely understand why there is such a big hype surrounding this exhibition. There are some really interesting pieces in this show. And, you know, we've got retired artists in the community, emerging artists. We've got some youth pieces in this show. And so I think it's kind of a really interesting perspective to be involved with the community on that level.
What's up right now that you find, I don't want you to be picking your favorites here, because I'm sure you love all the members show stuff, right?
I do.
Is there anything that you'd kind of like to highlight or note?
We have some really interesting 3D pieces. I'm always most impressed with the 3D pieces. We've got some really stunning handmade books this year. They are really, really interesting pieces. And several of our things in this show are for sale, so if you're looking for Christmas presents, it's a great place to come.
I see. Also, in your gift shop, you do sell art that is part of the Kentucky Crafted Consortium, I should say. It's a program of the Kentucky Arts Council, and it helps marketable artists in the Commonwealth find places to show their work, helps them get commissions, and also helps them find places to teach others what they do. And could you explain how the Iser's gift shop is working to get more Kentucky Crafted artists in the shop?
Well, right now we just have a few, mm-hmm. and we'd like to have several more. We'd like it to be filled with Kentucky Crafted things. We also want to keep children's items in the shop, too, so it'll always be a nice mix.
Mm-hmm.
I actually served on the panel for Kentucky Crafted items here recently, so as a newcomer to the state, it was really interesting to see how that program works. And while I was there, we got to see some really top-notch products. And so that really got me curious into how to expand those things into our shop. And right now we do have plans to attend the market, the Kentucky Crafted Market, which will be coming up in March, early March.
Teen Spirit is the show that's coming up as your first show for 2013. It opens January 20th and runs through February 16th. And in the past, it's featured work from young people at area schools in Western Kentucky. And I'm not sure if they've been outside Western Kentucky as well, maybe Southern Illinois. But who does the Iser work with to make this happen?
We right now are in the process of securing sponsorship for the show. But the juror for the show will be Paul Aho from the Paducah School of Art. And there will be several prizes gifted from the art school, cash prizes. And we're working on some other prize options. Last year, 12 area schools participated. And we've already gotten emails from Lexington and Louisville this year. So
oh, wow.
We're really, really excited about this year's show.
So have you received submissions yet or just letters of interest?
We have definitely received some letters of interest from various schools, and it sounds like teachers are working on getting their students' work together. The difference between this year and last year students could submit 3 works a piece, and that led to about 600 works, so
oh my goodness.
That doesn't sound like it would be very nice for the juror.
Yeah.
So this year, students will be encouraged to submit their best works and enter one piece for display in the show.
You mentioned that Paul Aho will be the juror, and I think it's pretty special to have high school students actually having someone who is a professional on that
exactly.
level
yeah.
Looking over their work and giving them maybe criticism or, you know, choosing work on that level that maybe somebody who is a professional artist would be judged on.
I think we immediately thought of Paul for this year because these are his future students. And we really want to work in any way possible with the art school. I think that's just the only way to go for us. Being the gateway for the arts, as we definitely strive to be. It just makes sense that we would collaborate with the art school in any way. And if we can at all help area students to focus on their work as artists, then that's what we're here to do.
So the Iser Arts Center is working with young people. It's working with its members who are more experienced artists and working to also, you know, sell art by people from the Kentucky Crafted program. So it sounds like you have a little bit of everything going on right now.
Yeah, we do. As a matter of fact, it's also business membership time. So if you or your family know of anyone that would be interested in a business membership at the Iser and help support the arts in your community as a business, always feel free to give us a call or check out our website for more information.
The Iser Arts Center Executive Director Josh White spoke with Angela Hatton from his office in Paducah. The Iser's current exhibit of work by its members is up through December 22nd. There's more information about the center and the show at WKMS.org.
This coming Friday, Playhouse in the Park opens a production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, but it's not just any production. It's a brand new adaptation of this immortal work by WKMS Sunday announcer Jeff Miller, who also directs the show. Kate Lochte spoke with Miller about the production and the perspective he brings to this beloved holiday hallmark.
Hearing from Lisa Cope that you are producing A Christmas Carol with your own adaptation, so maybe we should start with your telling us what you did to the story.
Okay. What I try to do is I try to go back to the original script of Dickens and pull from it the very best of what he had to offer as far as his sentiment towards the holiday and towards the people of his time and of our time. The story of Scrooge is a rather sad one, and I didn't want it to be too somber. So what I did was incorporate a great number of Christmas carols that are actually in the show. Carolers come out in several scenes and actually sing carols. They also sing carols during the scene changes in the show. And I did this to try to convey the idea that everyone around Scrooge was enjoying the holiday and really reveling in the goodwill towards men while Scrooge was closing himself off from all of those emotions.
Tell me about your cast.
I have a wonderful cast. I have Don Fleming performing as Scrooge. Elizabeth Hammonds is Mrs. Cratchit. Edwin Richardson is Bob Cratchit. Let's see, there's Jordan Belcher as the Ghost of Christmas Present. Chelim Anthony as the Ghost of Christmas Past. There are a number of college students from here at the university that are performing roles in the show. And they've all been just a fantastic cast to work with. They're very dedicated to the show, and they're really enjoying themselves, which is something that I try to create. I try to create an atmosphere where everybody can come in and really enjoy themselves. And I find that makes for a much better actor and a much better show.
Remind us of the occasion of Dickens writing this play.
It was a time in England, early Victorian era, where there was a great deal of class iniquity in England at that time. The poor were extraordinarily poor, and the wealthy were, had a tendency to really look down upon the people that were poor as people that were less than they were. And that's kind of one of the central themes in A Christmas Carol that Dickens wrote was a recognition that that was, in fact, not the case. You know, and he really tried hard through the writing of A Christmas Carol and also through other stories like Oliver Twist to really delineate that horrible attitude that the people of his time had towards those that were less fortunate than he was. So it was a time of a great deal of change in England. It was, you know, it was kind of in the first stages of the Industrial Revolution there. A lot of people had moved from the country to the cities to work in factories. Their labor was extraordinarily difficult. The working conditions were fantastically cruel. And I think this was his attempt to really bring all of that suffering to light so that people would recognize it and begin to change it.
What was the reception to it when its debut?
Was mixed, as it always was with his works that treated upon this. The upper classes tended to scoff a little bit at bringing this all to light. They would tend to downplay the severity of the conditions, but the general populace were really very interested in it, and Dickens wrote a lot of his works as continuing pieces in the newspaper or publishing company that he was writing for. So they would come out in installments, and people would eagerly await the next installment. I mean, I know that was very true for Oliver Twist.
It's one of those timeless pieces.
Absolutely, it is.
Now, you're not doing this all by yourself. You're not doing the lighting and the set and everything, right?
No, not completely by myself, no. Dan Fleming has been our resident scenic designer and carpenter at the Plain House for many, many years. He's assisted me, or I've assisted him, in the construction of the platforms that are used in the show. And Don Fleming, who's playing Scrooge, is going to be doing the lighting. And then we have Shelley Regan, who's doing our costumes. Elizabeth Hammonds is my stage manager. Jana Little is also assisting in costumes. And then all the rest of the cast and some of the parents of the children that are in the show are also assisting as far as coming up with the props and the other things that we need to make the production work.
Music direction?
Music direction is actually by myself and Elizabeth Hammonds. All the Christmas carols are sung a cappella by our actors in the show. I did this to really kind of make that part of the show as real as possible. I don't have them training as singers together very often. They come in and they sing as if people would if they were coming off the street and gathering together, you know, in an impromptu way to come in and sing Christmas carols. So it has a very organic and a very natural feel to it, and still a beautiful sound, because many of the people that are in the show have fantastic voices. You know, with just an added harmony to it here or there, it sounds really, really nice.
You seem fairly unpanicked at this point about a Christmas carol.
I'm putting up a tremendous front, you know. I've posted on my Facebook page the last couple of days. I've been having horrible actors' nightmares, where it's always 5 minutes to curtain, and I don't know what scene's coming up next, and I can't find my costumes, and I don't know what's going on, and that's just a reflection of the anxiety that I really feel on the inside. I have been doing this for a long time, so I know that it's always darkest 2 weeks before curtain, which is about where we are right now, and that's when it seems to the most terrifying. You don't think you're ever going to make it, and somehow it always comes together. So we're pretty well on with our set building and everything like that, so I'm not too concerned about that, and the actors are really doing a fantastic job. So by a week from this coming Friday, it should be all sewn together, and it should be a fantastic show.
Well, bravo.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Jeff Miller directs A Christmas Carol for Murray's Playhouse in the Park. The show opens Friday, December 7th, and runs at 7 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays, and at 2:30 p.m. Sundays through December 16th. 2012 marks the 200th birthday of Charles Dickens, who wrote A Christmas Carol. The novella has remained in print ever since it was first published in 1843. You could say Murray resident Tina Hook got her Christmas a little sooner than the rest of us. Her first novel was published earlier this year, and when we come back, she'll tell us about it. We'll also head out to the LBL to find out what once lived and died there millions of years ago. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Tina Hook lives in Murray and is now a published author. Her first novel, Enchanted by Starlight, was published earlier this year in paperback and on the Kindle. One blogger says the book is, quote, chick lit with just a hint of the paranormal. The story is about three women whose lives take an extraordinary turn when an enchanted comet gives each of them a special power. One uses hers to become a socialite, another can make men fall in love with her, and the third uses hers to seek revenge. Hook originally hails from Florida, and her blog, GirlWithANewLife.com, is a collection of her memories, flash fiction, and inspirations. And she spoke with Angela Hatton about them.
You were a writer when you were very young. You started writing as a child, and then as you grew older, you realized that being a writer didn't make a lot of money, and you decided to switch your aspirations, and from what I understand, you eventually became an investment advisor, which is much different from being a writer. What made you come back to writing fiction?
Gosh, you know, I spent 10 years in investment advice, and 10 years is long enough to know if something's a fit or if it's not a fit. I think the thing I loved about that job so much was connecting with people and their stories, which is just a part of giving people advice regardless of what part of their life it is, financial included. But just after 10 years, I thought, I'm turning 30, it's just time to go back to the thing I really want to do.
And you started a regular writing routine by starting a blog?
Yes, blogging has been a great way to kind of out my writing, so to speak, and a lot of new writers are connecting with each other this way. It's a fantastic way to kind of launch yourself into an audience when you don't have one yet. And it's really fulfilling in a way. It's a form of instant gratification that you can't get when you're writing fiction.
What do you mean by instant gratification in the blogosphere?
Instant gratification means I can write something in 30 minutes, publish it instantly, and have my audience and my community give me feedback within the same 24 hours that I wrote something. I think when you're writing fiction, it's more of a 2 to 3 year journey before something hits print, so you're not really getting that automatic feedback that you get with a blog.
Did that help you finish Enchanted by Starlight?
Yes, it really, really did. I can't say this enough. My blog audience held me accountable. They asked me where my page count was. I think I put a counter on my own blog so they could see when I was slacking off and when I wasn't slacking off. And it really did light a fire under me and made me finish.
You now have your book published, your first novel, which I'm sure is a good feeling to have that completed work to showcase. And you actually commented on your experience of being a new author as a guest blogger for letmeoutcreative.com. And I'd like to share what you said because I really love the way you put this. This is, what is funny about this journey is that the fireworks never really go off. After spending years of my life writing, no one charges into my house one day and stamps author onto all of my business cards. Nor is there a secret society of super fascinating writers all wanting to make my acquaintance, at least none that I've been invited to. And I love that because it recognizes that being published is not the end of it. It doesn't change you in and of itself. But you do mention journey in here. And so what is it about writing that is a journey for you?
Gosh, I think that writing is something, and maybe this is true for every creative endeavor, that you always can improve upon. And I think you build an audience really slowly and incrementally over many years. It's not something that happens overnight. I think finding an audience is a really great big challenge in this World Wide Web where people have zillions of choices of things they could be reading. I think the journey of writing is just putting one foot in front of the other and being really brave, and you just keep going.
And you've also said that, you know, one reason you were afraid of writing early on was you felt that it exposed yourself a bit more than maybe you were comfortable with. Are you more comfortable now? How has that changed?
I think you just get used to it. I think creative writing is such an emotional giving of yourself. I think that's probably true with most creative endeavors. I think you get a little bit more used to it. I think you get a thicker skin about it. And I think you just get a little bit more courageous every time you release something.
Enchanted by Starlight, I kind of think it sort of crosses genres a little bit. You know, it has a bit of magical realism in it, and it also has, I guess, romance in it as well, and personal story, personal journey. You have an excerpt with you from the very beginning of the book, and I was wondering if you could read it and just give us a taste of your novel.
I would love to. So here goes nothing. My name is Grace. Tomorrow is my wedding day. Staring across the dark waters of the Gulf, I am uncertain. I am exhausted and hopeful. I am both completely in love and irreparably heartbroken. After these long months attending to the minutiae, the black and white stationery, the elegant table settings, the tropical flowers, the chocolate dessert course, I suddenly find myself detached from it completely, and now, with the night sky rising up around me, I have surrendered myself to the deeper implications. I am standing in the moment that has defined my life. I am finally here, and yet so much has been lost. It was a delicious ache that lured me from my bed tonight, drawing me out beneath the cobweb of stars. Liam's memory teases me, calling me from the water's edge, as if he might materialize there, simply by my wanting him to. I thought for sure I had pushed him so far back in my mind that I had forced him away for good. Still, as much as he has denied me, as much as I have refused my heart, it seems he is determined to make an impression on this day. Agonizing, really, how enduring love can be. Even after you have packed it up and put it away, it is still there. Always there, yellowing around the edges and begging you to turn its pages again.
Hmm. And I feel like you're very attached to these pages. You feel something when you read them, and it's obvious.
Absolutely. I think as a writer, as a creative writer, you really have to go to those vulnerable places, and I am extremely attached to the book and to the story.
you're now working on a second installment in this with the same characters, same story?
Yes, I'm writing the second in the series, which I'm so excited about. It's titled She Wishes, which is the continuation of my three protagonists and kind of taking them to the next step in their story.
And so is this something that you're going to be writing about for a while, you think?
I think so. I think the second is writing itself faster than the first because I've got my momentum going, but I'm hoping to do a trilogy.
And you have an event coming up in town here in Murray that people can go to if they wish and actually meet you and see more about your book?
Yes, I'm doing a book signing at the University Bookstore on December 5th from 11 to 1. So that will be a fantastic opportunity to come out and see the book and meet me and have fun.
Tina Hook, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Tina Hook's first novel, Enchanted by Starlight, is available on Amazon.com.
Retired banker Harold Dorn of Murray joined the National Board of the Diabetes Research Institute Foundation in 2005, and last year he became the board's chair. Dorn speaks with Kate Lochte about how a surprising diagnosis in 1994 led his family to the institute and their support for it.
Last year, you were elected national chairman of the Diabetes Research Institute Foundation. It's based in Florida, and I'd like you to tell me how you got involved with that.
Well, my son, Will, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes on April 26, 1994. Since that time, I've been actively interested in trying to help find a cure for this disease. And my wife and I researched several different organizations that we felt that we could affiliate with in order to help do what we could to find a cure. Now, we're not scientists, but I'm a retired business guy, and I've been very fortunate, and I was hopeful that I could invest with an organization some of my time and treasury to help find this cure. We're like a lot of parents. We attended a lot of conferences to see what we could do to help our child live better with this disease. And in one of those information sessions at a conference, we met some people from the Diabetes Research Institute, which is based in Miami, Florida, and is connected with the University of Miami. And we were just very impressed with some of the things they had going on research-wise down there. And we decided to make a visit to the institute later that year. And we were toured through the facility. We got to meet a lot of the scientists who are actually the people that are looking through the microscopes every day trying to find this cure. It's kind of the Manhattan Project for the cure of type 1 diabetes. They have 140 scientists, physicians, engineers, people from a lot of different disciplines that are all working together every day to find the cure.
How has your family seen the approach to type 1 change from the point of your son being diagnosed to now? How old is he now?
He's 21. He's a junior at Tulane University. And we were like a lot of parents. Before Will was diagnosed, we didn't know a lot about type 1 diabetes. But once that happened on April 26 of 94, we became very knowledgeable about the disease and how you live with it. And the, I guess, silver lining, if there is one in any disease, is particularly a chronic disease such as type 1 diabetes, is that you can live with the disease. And there have been a lot of advances made lifestyle-wise to make it easier for people that have this disease to live with it. That does not mitigate the seriousness of the disease or the problems that you face having the disease going forward, which necessitates this drive and desire to find a cure.
Tell me how your family realized that Will had this disease.
Well, actually, my wife had taken our two kids with another mom and her two kids to Gulf Shores, Alabama for a few days. And Will was just really thirsty. And in fact, he was so thirsty, he was drinking pool water. My wife was afraid I was going to make him sick, so she stopped by a local doctor's office there in Gulf Shores, just thinking that she might ought to get him something that maybe, you know, drinking pool water was going to make him sick, and they were getting ready to get on the road to drive back to Murray. And the doctor was a young doctor, and she started asking Kelly questions about, you know, well, does Will drink pool water often? And she said, well, you know, he's 2 years old. You know, who knows what a two-year-old does? But no, not normally. And she said, hang on just a minute. I want to check something. So the doctor, I guess, did a finger prick to get a blood sample and did a blood sugar reading that showed Will was 537. And she came back and told Kelly that your son has type 1 diabetes. We're going to put him in an ambulance and take him to Children's Hospital in Pensacola right now. So that was our introduction to diabetes. We had no history of it in our family at all, which is the case for about 50% of the type 1 diabetes diagnosis.
How did your lifestyles change?
Any parent of a diabetic child will tell you it's just a constant concern and worry about your child, because it is a disease that can do damage and you have to stay on top of it. And it does affect not only your child, but it affects your child's siblings and your child's parents and grandparents. It affects the whole family because you're constantly on guard to make sure that your child's blood sugar is in the right zone, to make sure that he or she has enough to eat, that he or she is being active, that he or she has enough insulin to counteract the effects of eating. It's a balancing act.
Am I understanding that the nighttime watches is particularly critical, especially for kids?
Especially for kids, nighttime is critical. One of the reasons for that is because they are very sleepy. I mean, again, they may wake up and not realize that their blood sugar levels are dropping because they are so tired to begin with. So, and many of the unfortunate things that happen to type 1 kids happen at night. In fact, when my son was ready to get his big boy bed, we bought him a bunk bed. And I'd always wanted a bunk bed when I was a kid, my brother and I, but my parents would never buy us one. I think they were afraid we would throw each other off the top of it or something. But so I bought Will a bunk bed, and I showed it to my mother, and she said, well, you finally got your bunk bed. So I slept on the top bunk for the next 8 years. So just, you know, out of an abundance of caution to have somebody there and to monitor him during the night and make sure that that he didn't, his blood sugar level didn't drop and that we didn't have a problem.
How did your daughter get involved?
Well, my daughter was thrown into it just like we were, because you didn't have a choice. And she was older, and she was always a caregiver anyway. So she always took very good care of her younger brother and would make sure that he had his insulin pens, or made sure that he had a juicy juice or a juice with him, because again, when your blood sugar drops, you need some immediate sugar in your system. You get that through juice or candy or whatever, it would immediately release or more quickly release into your body. So she always made sure his supplies were adequate, and she always just kind of watched him like we did too. You know, there are some telltale signs you can kind of see when your blood sugar is dropping that if you pay attention, you can help head off an issue. And so she was very helpful in that regard too.
I'd like to go back to your role as a fundraiser and ask what your annual goals are for fundraising.
Our budget's about $14 million this year, and we've raised close to $200 million toward this cure since our founding about 40 years ago. And this was founded by a bunch of moms and dads that had children with diabetes, and they banded together to try to start research at the University of Miami that would be focused on finding a cure for their children. And it's grown out of that. And today, like I said, we've got 140 people there. It's probably the largest research facility in the country dedicated to finding a cure for type 1 diabetes.
Does Will face any special challenges having been diagnosed so young?
Well, only the challenge is the fact that he is a type 1 diabetic. Nothing more compounding, given that he was diagnosed earlier. It just means that really, in his case, that's all he's ever known.
Harold Oren is chair of the National Board of Directors of the Diabetes Research Institute Foundation. We have a link to the foundation's website at wkms.org.
$100 million years ago, you'd have needed a boat to do your Christmas shopping around here. Back then, our region was at the bottom of a vast, shallow sea called the Western Interior Seaway. This body of water deposited countless fossils here in the mid to late Cretaceous period. A little more recently, WKMS youth reporter Aaron Siegel went searching for the fossils of these brachiopods and trilobites with naturist Andrea Woody in the land between the lakes. He brings us this report of the weird-looking creatures that once called Western Kentucky home.
Okay, hi, I'm Aaron Siegel here, and I'm with Andrea Woody and the fossil hunt at LBL. What got you interested in fossils?
Well, I'm really into nature. I was a wildlife major in college, and this was actually something I had never, ever done before. So I decided it was time to learn about fossils.
What kind of fossils are we looking for exactly?
Well, we're looking for fossils that come from the Paleozoic era, which is a fancy way to say a really, really long time ago. And these are going to be mostly marine animals, like really small marine animals. Some of them are going to be related to current starfish that we have. Some are going to be related to really weird animals that exist called Bryozoans. They look like aliens. They're really gross.
So like shells and
so
mostly shells, because like I know starfish material doesn't really get fossilized because like skin mostly and
well,
such.
There's this animal called a blastoid, and it looks like a rosebud, and it's related to a starfish.
Where do these fossils come from? Like oceans, like land?
Yes.
How did they get on here? How did they get here? Yeah.
Well, a long, long time ago, the world looked really different. And here in Kentucky and Tennessee, instead of having this land mass with these mountains that we have, it used to be an ocean, a really shallow ocean. So there used to be lots of aquatic marine animals that lived there. And when the mountains formed in Kentucky and Tennessee on the east side, it created kind of like this pit of dead animals, and the ground grew up on top of them and created all these fossils. So when the mountains came, they died. That's where all these animals are from.
What other kinds of things were alive at the time? Not like in this area, but like at the actual time, what other stuff was alive?
Well, something that's kind of crazy that you can actually find in different parts of Kentucky is shark teeth. There used to be like shark-like animals that lived in the ocean. So that's different. Let me see, what else can you see? You can see these animals that look like squids. They're squids that lived kind of like a snail. They lived inside of a hard shell. So all you find, you don't find the soft tissues of the squid. You find just the shells that they lived in.
Weren't they like the cone shell things? Like the really spirally cone shells?
Yeah, they kind of look like ice cream cones.
Yeah, those are really funny because they're just kind of swirly. Yeah. Like, those are hilarious. I love those.
One of the most common fossils that we have are called crinoids. And they're this aquatic animal that looks like a plant. And most people see them and don't even realize it because they're just little round. They look like rusty, fat pennies. People call them Indian pennies. And people see them all the time and don't even realize it's a fossil.
Are there other things that, like, outside of Kentucky that you could find, like, that were around at that time?
Yeah, like, different places have different eras in them. Like, this part of Kentucky and Tennessee, we have a lot of things from the Mississippian era. But other parts of Kentucky and Tennessee and other parts of the world might have something that's a little bit, I guess, newer, like dinosaur bones. We're not going to have a lot of dinosaur bones here because they happened a lot later. And we're going to get things that are really, really old.
Like billions, not millions.
Billions of years old. Yeah, exactly right.
I know you can find a lot of fossil shells. Can you find fossil mussels and stuff here?
There's this animal that lived back then that was called a brachiopod. And it is actually really closely related to clams, but it's just like one slight difference makes them a little bit different. So you're not going to find the exact type of mussels that we have today because they're ancestors of the mussels that we have today.
Aren't mussels today endangered?
Well, some mussels are endangered and some aren't. Some are having issues in different habitats. Like if someone messes with their habitat, they can become endangered in a certain place. But in general, mussels are doing all right. It's just certain species that are struggling.
Yeah, the mussels, you don't want them to die out. They're delicious.
They are delicious.
Have you found any fossils of certain organisms that have surprised you?
Yeah, actually, I know this might sound weird, but I've seen fern fossils. And that's weird and surprising because most fossils are going to be hard things like shells. Soft tissue, like a plant, is really, really hard to fossilize. So it's always really exciting when you see a fossil of something that's a soft tissue, like skin or a plant.
Yeah, don't like sometimes reptiles, the scales fossilize?
Exactly right, yeah. Some fossils that they find of like dinosaurs will have a little bit of skin still attached to the bone, which is really cool.
I remember I heard about one that they found the heart which was really weird because it was like giant. It was like a one-ton heart.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It wasn't actually one ton, but you know, the rock made it like weigh a lot more.
Well, when they find those soft tissues, it's usually really exciting because do you know they don't even know what color the T-Rex is?
Yeah, they don't know what color anything is.
Yeah,
doubt it.
Yeah, they don't find the skin. So when they find the skin, it's usually really exciting.
So we're hunting in the winter or close to the winter. We're hunting in like mid-November. So what is the best season for fossil hunting, or is there one at all?
Yeah, well, it depends on where you live. We like to do it here in the winter in November because the area that we go to consistently that we know has a lot of fossils, it's underwater in other seasons. So the water's down right now, so we can go and see all the fossils that we want.
I'm Aaron Sickle here with Ms. Woody, and we are actually at the fossil site right now. This is called Ginger Ridge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ginger Ridge and the Tennessee part of LBL.
Okay, just kind of a shore. Are we at Kentucky Lake?
Yeah, we are looking at the Kentucky Lake. Right now we're in the Ginger Bay, and right through there is Kentucky Lake.
Yes, we're in Tennessee, and we're in Kentucky Lake. You heard right. Well, we were just looking for some fossils, and we found some really neat stuff. Hey, come here for a second. And there's just, wow, just this big old shell here.
Really big rocks, like really large rocks, and they just have tons and tons of crinoids, which are those plant-like animals, just scattered all through them. And then you have some really big, big shells. They're called brachiopods, like this one right here. You can definitely see that it's like a shell.
Yes.
And the whole shoreline, which is normally underwater, is just littered with these big rocks full of tiny, tiny fossils. They're really small.
And we found a little sedimentary rock, like layers on layers of rock, where you can actually now see the layers.
So basically, this is a rock that has broken in half, and it's like a slice, right? So slice right down the middle. And if you look, you can see the different layers of rocks as it formed over time. And you can also see, amidst those layers, these different little animals, these crinoids, the circular little animals, all through it, all through the layers. And that's basically the whole idea of how fossils are formed, is they just form between different layers of sedimentary rock.
There's also just this really big rock chunk over here. It's probably about, say it's about like 2 feet maybe?
2 to 3 feet wide.
And it's just littered with fossils, just crinoid stems and brachiopods. Brachiopods, yes.
Yeah, I would say those are probably the most two common types of fossils that we're going to see today. But we need to keep our eyes open for corals, which are really rare. And we might also get to see some trilobites as well.
That would be real neat. Trilobites are animals, right?
Yeah, all of these are animals, just some of them kind of look like plants.
Yeah, most of them look like plants. Trilobites were like moving animals,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, trilobites, I would describe them as like half bug, half
like
crab.
Like shrimpy crab things.
Yes, they're really interesting looking.
What kind of guidance would you give visitors if they came here?
Yeah, if they came here. If someone, a visitor, wanted to fossil hunt on their own, I would just recommend for them to plan for everything. For example, the weather. If you were to come out here by the water, it could be really cold on a windy day. You also want to make sure that somebody knows where you are, because you are kind of out in the middle of nowhere, so you don't want to get like stuck in your car or something like that. You also want to make sure you bring water. It's always good to have water. And you also want to make sure that you don't take anything when you come to visit, because you can't take these fossils home with you. They're part of the park. You can look at them and take pictures, but you cannot take them home. This site is awesome because normally it's underwater. So you just drive in like we did today. We came in off of Road 206 today, so you can probably just find that on a map.
You can see pictures of Aaron's LBL fossil hunt at WKMS.org. Our special thanks to Aaron's mom, WKMS Youth Project volunteer Clara Fuller, for coordinating the interview and the photos. You can also learn more about our youth radio projects and how your child can get involved by emailing us at msu.wkms@murraystate.edu.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and John Walker. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
We welcome your questions or comments about the stories you've heard today. You can email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu, post them to our Facebook page, or tweet them to @WKMS. You can find links to all three at WKMS.org. You can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.